Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4, testing.
This is tape number 10, side 1, in a continuing interview with Edward F. Pritchard for the Kentucky Oral History Commission on April 15, 1983.
Mr. Pritchard, when you returned, well, first of all, you were talking, as we ended yesterday, Wednesday, about some of your first encounters with politics upon your return from Washington. You mentioned the first time you'd gone into Woodford County. You want to relate that? We didn't get that on tape.
Well, the first time I remember going into Woodford County in any political way was in 1937, when I was still on friendly relations with Governor Chandler, and they were having county elections, legislative elections. It was the midterm of the Chandler administration, and they were having a rally at the courthouse in Versailles. And Happy asked Marion Howard to bring the old Versailles to speak at that rally, and they had a good crowd in the courthouse. We had a lively speaking. That was the first time I remember meeting Paul Jackson, and of course, others that I can remember being there were Mr. Drake Nave, who was then the District Highway Commissioner, Mr. Jack Corman. I don't know whether Mr. Jack was a deputy sheriff then or not. Maybe when he first went in the sheriff's office, but he was there. And Mr. Hiram Wilhoit, who was then the banking commissioner, and a lot of the other. Bill Stewart, who I believe was running even for the legislature or the state senate. Mr. George Dunlap, who I believe was in the House then, in the legislature. And that was my first foray into Woodford County politics, and probably my last up until about 1960.
Just as a matter of curiosity, what were the trappings? I mean, just the courthouse room when they had it decorated up, or what was the mode of those things in?
Well, this wasn't such a major rally that they would have had a lot of decorations. It was just held in the courtroom, and, we speakers went up to the judge's seat and stood there and spoke. It wasn't... it wasn't. Now, when Chandler had run for governor in 1935 in the second primary, and I believe I talked a little about that earlier, he opened his campaign in the second primary, the runoff primary, in Paris. And they had me make a little speech there. Of course, I wasn't old enough to vote at that time, but I would say we had 8,000 or 10,000 people there that day. It filled that whole town, and it was out in front of the courthouse. That courthouse comes up with a bank series of steps, and this was held on the sort of platform of bank that is below the flight of steps that leads you right to the portico. And we had a huge crowd there that night. Happy spoke. Mr. Wallace, who had been a candidate and eliminated in the first primary, spoke. Those days, 1935, the 30s, you could still draw huge crowds to a political open. And that was a great big outdoor meeting that, you'd have a public address system. But this one was a much smaller rally just in the courtroom. Miss Lydia Nave was there. I remember that. And
she was a circuit clerk.
I believe she was at that time.
She
succeeded a man named Claude Witt, didn't she?
Yes, sir.
Who had been in for many years. And I don't know that Mr. Witt was all that close to Chandler. But Miss Lelia followed him, and she was the circuit clerk then.
Well, Chandler ran Miss Lelia against Mr. Whit.
Was that it?
Yes.
She had defeated Mr. Claude Whit. That's right.
See, I remember her telling me he threw the keys on the desk and walked out the day she walked in and never told her anything about the office.
That's right. He had been clerk for years. And the county clerk at that time was Mr. Gray, isn't that right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And he lived a long time after he went out as clerk. I think he retired voluntarily.
Yes, sir.
And as I recall, he was living up into the 60s.
Now, you returned from Washington in the fall of 45?
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of know what kind of city we're in. What kind of lifestyle did you come back to? What were things like then?
Well, of course, it was a period when the war was just over, and everybody was coming back home, and the universities, colleges, which had been depopulated, were suddenly bursting with new students. Everybody was trying to get an education. Particularly servicemen and others who had maybe worked in war industries and hadn't gone to college were trying to get in. The GI Bill of Rights was probably one of the most potent forces in life, the society and life of the country at that time. The GI Bill was a major factor in the great burst of prosperity and economic growth and activity that came in the post-war period. And literally thousands of young people, and some of them not all that young, you know, veterans and others, were taking college courses and had all these temporary buildings out at the University of Kentucky. They didn't have any dormitories. They had these temporary buildings, student housing of a kind of rudimentary nature, and then lots of others who weren't going to college were taking various vocational courses. They were filling the vocational schools, such as they were. And of course, in the beginning, things like automobiles, household appliances, which had been shut down as far as the manufacturing production was concerned during the war, were just beginning to come back, and people were standing in line to get cars. I remember that my father had placed an order for a Cadillac with Dixie McKinley and was one of the top on the list. I can remember when he finally got that car. It was still required some doing to build a house because the building of houses had been shut down virtually during World War II. And at first you had shortages and scarcities. The rationing was ended, and then everyone had expected a big period of unemployment and depression when the war was over, such as we had after World War I. But we didn't have it. We moved into a really humming period of growth and prosperity at that time. And that seemed to be a dominant theme at that time. There was young people were getting married very quickly, having children very quickly, and that couldn't all take place at once, but it was very evident in those late 40s. And politics was dominated by the issues of the post-war period of transition to peacetime economy. The state had been unable to build any roads during that period. the state had been unable to build any public buildings or projects during that period. Consequently, the state of Kentucky, like all the states and many of the other units of government, except the federal government, had accumulated very substantial surpluses at that time, and the question was what to do with those surpluses. Some wanted to use them for education, others wanted to use them for constructing public projects, and there was a great demand for highway building. And those were the things I remember in the political side. Certainly there was a great change in the lifestyle, based primarily on the mobility which had occurred during World War II. People who had been raised in rural areas, farming areas, small towns, were transplanted. Some went in the service and were in the Pacific or in the European theater. Others had been in the big training camps, army posts, and they were no longer simply acquainted with people of their own background and their own upbringing. They met new people. And there seemed to me that was the beginning of the tendency which has accelerated ever since for greater mobility, of a more temporary character for everything. The permanence and tradition which had characterized life in this section for so many years began to be shaken up and changed. Not only were people in the service abroad and in the army encampments, but thousands had gone to various war industries, some in elsewhere in Kentucky, some in Ohio and Michigan, Indiana, and some of those people stayed and never came back. And so people in Kentucky, perhaps for the first time, had numerous relatives who lived in those, in Detroit or Toledo or Chicago or in Indiana, and who or in Dayton, and came back for vacations. People would go to visit their relatives. So there was a greater sense of mobility and of broader aspects of life. Many of the blacks who had never lived outside these small towns, and even in these small towns, had lived in the little black settlements that were on the edges of these small towns, like Claysville and Ruckerville over in Paris, or like Jacksontown or Woolridge Town or Russelltown over in Versailles. Some of them had worked in war plants or been in the service. And they came back with different ideas about society and the community. And that set in motion forces of change which have continued ever since. It was really a breaking point, a starting point for much that was new and much that's come in the last 35 years.
When you did come back, what was your civic or community involvement or church involvement? Did that change most by the time you left, and left, obviously, you were more eligible for civic clubs and that sort of thing? I guess what I'm trying to get at, as a starting young lawyer, did you do the normal things that young lawyers do, join the Kiwanis Club,
no,
the Lions Club?
No, not a one of them. I never joined the civic club of that character until I joined the Optimist Club in Frankfurt about 1960, or whenever, shortly after I located my practice in Frankfurt. I was invited to speak at many of them, and was kind of a, I was kind of a public utility as far as being called on to speak at various clubs and civic occasions was concerned, but as far as my church affiliation was concerned, I'd been reared a Methodist. My mother was raised in the Methodist church, although she sang in the choir of the Presbyterian church and really didn't attend the Methodist church very much, but my grandparents on my mother's side were very devout Methodists, and they had sort of guided me into the Methodist church. But when I had been away, I had not been a regular, consistent church attendant. And when I came back after the war, I wasn't a regular churchgoer until I went in the Episcopal Church after we were married. I don't know that in that period, I don't know that church attendance was all that much in vogue. That was later.
We talked last time about some of the clients you represent, one of those rural co-ops.
That was one of them.
What about do you recall that your time frame from when you returned and you practiced law? What maybe some of your more outstanding or controversial or interesting cases may have been?
Oh.
We're talking about the time frame when you returned and you got to do difficult.
Oh, I don't know. I remember representing the local bus company in the hearings that came up. They'd had a nickel bus fare, I believe it was, either a nickel or a dime in Lexington for many years. And the local bus company made an application for increase in the fare, I think to 15 cents or two for a quarter. And we had to be surprised what a stir that created. We had a very fully attended hearing up at the City Hall here in Lexington before the City Commission. And I recall that John Breckinridge represented the protester. That in retrospect doesn't sound very dramatic. I can remember.
Did you do much criminal law?
Well, not an overwhelming amount, though some. I used to represent some of the local bookmakers when they got in trouble and would try to get them leniency in the police courts. I always had a great fondness for the bookmakers. Many of them were my very good friends, and they really were pretty good fellows. I can remember Ernest Welch here had a handbook up in the Drake Hotel, Bill Keith, Joe Keith, Chris Burns, several of them around Lexington here, and I'd occasionally represent them. They weren't big pay, but I sort of enjoyed it. I can remember one criminal case I had. The chief of police here, Austin Price, who was a good friend of mine, was indicted for nonfeasance in office because the grand jury was persuaded by Mr. Bill Townsend that he didn't send enough police out to deal with the strike of the employees of the bus company. That was before I represented the bus company in their fare increase. And I remember we got that indictment dismissed. This was just a political maneuver to try to break the strike. Then there were quite a few people who thought that because I had been in Washington, that I could represent them in matters involving the federal government. I remember there were several people that had problems with the OPA, Price Administration, that employed me to represent them in Washington, and several companies. I remember I handled a big case for, you know, the big distillery. The other one that would be as big as Shen, you know. They bought out Frankfurt Distilling Company. It's on the tip of my tongue. They had a big problem with the price, OPA.
Just don't worry about those.
Weren't they Canadian originally? Anyway, I remember handling some litigation for them. But a lot of it was just ordinary cases.
Well, let's talk about the Clemens Water Store issue a little bit. We talked about it before. What were some of the main issues of that campaign? Are issues really important?
Well, you can never tell. The one of the issues, of course, was the question of whether Clemens was too much in alliance with the private utilities. Waterfield and Phil Ardred tried very hard to make that the issue, and I suppose that I was useful to Clemens in blunting that issue, because I'd been prominently identified with the co-op side, and we managed to split the support of the co-ops, and I don't think that ever pleased Phil very much. That's the first time I ever met J.R. Miller.
During that campaign?
Mm-hmm.
Which side was he on? Was he active in that campaign?
I think he started out for Waterfield and ended up for Clemens. And after that, became very close to Clemens. And all the other issue was that Clemens was the candidate of the portrayed Clemens as a candidate of the political bosses and the machine politicians, and Waterfield as a younger, fresher candidate, more in tune with the people. Waterfield had managed Ben Kilgore's campaign for governor against Lytle Donaldson in the 1943 primary, and it sort of made the machine and the old politics the issue. So when Waterfield ran, why, Ben Kilgore managed his campaign. And they tried to continue that line of attack. But a great deal of it was just political factions lining up on one side or the other. Lytle Donaldson supported Waterfield. Courier Journal supported Waterfield. And Joe Leary, some of the old Chandler crowd supported Clemens. And Clemens himself had been in the Tom Ray LaFoon faction, so he got a lot of support from that group too.
Was there any overall strategy for the Clemens campaign?
Were you privy to that? Well, I was privy to everything in it. I think the strategy was to just get enough votes to win. That's right, and raise enough money. And of course, not nearly. Clemens raised a good deal of money from the horse people. He raised a good deal of money from the liquor people. The liquor people were very anxious to get an amendment to the local option law that allowed cities of the first four classes to vote separately from a county unit, so that if a county was dry, you could let the county seat vote wet, as Pikeville has done recently, or Russellville. In those days, you couldn't do that. And so, I think Clemens, what his commitment to the liquor people was, he said, now, I can't come out openly support this legislation, but I'll try to help you pass it in the legislature, and then if you pass it, I'll let it become law without my signature. And that happened in 1948 after he was elected. They passed that amendment. And the Speaker of the House, who was a Carmelite preacher named Tinsley from up in Gallatin County, felt that it would be an embarrassment for him to preside over the House when that bill was passed. He might have to gavel through a few motions. So he had a sudden attack of stomach ache, and they took him to the mansion, and Dr. Boffman ministered to him, and they let a fellow named Hobart Rabin, who was the Republican floor leader, act as speaker and hold a chair, and he was, I have no doubt, compensated by the liquor people. And he conducted the proceedings, and they passed that bill in the House and Senate, and Clemens let it become law. And that's how many of our towns, particularly here in central Kentucky, which were in dry counties, became wet. Towns like Shelbyville, Mount Sterling, Nicholasville. I have a notion that Clemens, as a result of the contributions some of the horse people made, I think he probably appointed some of the people they wanted on the racing commission. That was considered one of the most prestigious purchasable positions in state government. I think Clemens, Waterfield probably tried to make the education people support him, and some of them did. And then Clemens, in turn, accused Waterfield of making commitments that would cause big tax increases, and that probably hurt Waterfield. But there weren't any dynamic issues, other than the ones I've told you about, which...
Well, what about the efforts to involve special groups like the campaigns today involve senior citizens, small business, and all that breaking out?
No.
Did Clemens make a special effort to involve the veterans?
Well, he did that because he had served in World War I, and Waterfield had not served in the Army. And that was a sort of subliminal issue. Yes, Clemens, I think, got very effective support from some of the veterans. You know, he didn't overtly raise the issue, but they used to...
Sort of promise or platform?
No, no. Clemens had a couple of people who had been veterans, like Doc Beecham, you know, who had served overseas in that war. I'm not sure Doc wasn't in both wars. He was very young in World War I and quite at the upper age limit for World War II. And Doc and some of his cohorts would go in every town and slip some handbills out, you know, which pointed out that Waterfield had not been in the Army. And that was very effective against Waterfield.
Do you remember a fellow named Howard Bowles?
Sure I do.
Very active person in the veterans. At least that was what I was advised some years ago. He was very active in the veterans. Is that active?
Yeah. He never did have much prominence in politics after that. I remember Howard. He's still living. I believe he's rich as Muffet has it.
We've just talking now about Howard Bowles, who was active in Governor Clemens' campaign for governor with veterans.
That's right. And then Howard would, from time to time, reemerge in political campaigns, but I never thought he was terribly effective. He was always seemed to me to be kind of a big fella, as we used to say, and I really haven't followed him through the years, but every once in a while he'll call me. Last I heard, his mother was living here in Lexington.
You recall any particularly interesting stories about the Waterfield Clemens race, any precinct tales, perhaps some particularly colorful campaign personalities?
Well, it wasn't a colorful campaign. Clemens was not a colorful candidate, neither was Waterfield. There was, as I recall, a rather light vote in the primary. We still, you know, it took a while after the war when people had moved around so much and so many of them been away in the service to get people back to voting. Beginning in the war, voting patterns began to get very different. And we always thought that was one of the reasons that Judge Willis beat Mr. Donaldson, was because so many Democrats were away in the service and didn't vote, even though they had a right to, and that so many Kentucky in Detroit and Ohio in war plans and didn't vote, that probably was the cause of Donaldson's defeat. He only lost by 6,000 votes. And in 1947, people had not become immersed in politics. Now, the next year in the presidential election, they came in much more and voted. But it was a fairly light vote and not a colorful campaign. Clemens, it was a highly organized campaign. Not professional by present standards, but very professional by the standards of that day.
What do you mean, highly organized?
Well, he had a good organization of the old-fashioned sort, you know. County politicians mobilized, precinct workers mobilized. Clemens had a very wide acquaintance in the state. And his point was not to go make an eloquent speech. He was a very boring speaker, ponderous, and not at all eloquent in the ordinary sense. But he was very good at just going into a community and talking to key people and influential people and mobilize them. And he knew how to get to them. And that was really the strength of his campaign. Waterfield tried to make it more populist type of campaign, but he just didn't quite have the personality to swing it. And Clemens had the support of Miss Lenny McLaughlin and the Louisville organization, which was very powerful at that time. Clemens had the support of Beecham and what was left of the Ray organization in that part of western Kentucky. He had the support of Dick Maloney and the political leaders in this county, which was one of his banner counties. Waterfield had, his organization support was mainly what Mr. Donaldson could mobilize for him and what he could do through his contacts with members of the legislature with whom he served as speaker. And they had the favorable regard of the Courier Journal. Clemens had the Lexington Herald support. Tom Underwood managed his campaign nominally. Beecham did more to build his organization than anybody.
Did Chandler support Lawrence Underwood?
No. He quietly supported Clemens. And several of the old Chandler crowd were for Clemens. I don't guess all of them were, but Vigo Barnes was, Joe Leary was, Dan Talbert was. Dan, of course, had become estranged from Chandler by that time. Dan Talbert was very hard up. He had gotten older, was not well, lived over at the Kentucky Hotel, and Judge Charles I. Dawson gave him a sort of a little job with the Kentucky Home Life Insurance Company, and that was enough for him to live on. And he felt that Happy had been ungrateful to him and had not paid much attention to him. And so, but he supported Clemens. Bob Hensley, who came out of the Chandler crowd, was very active in Clemens's headquarters. That was the first time Cathy Lou Miller got into politics. She had just finished high school not long before, and she came and worked in his headquarters in the Sealback Hotel. And that was the beginning of her long and rather distinguished career in politics and government. But it was not an exciting campaign in the sense that people were stirred.
Did you? I guess you spent very little time in the campaign effort.
Yes, I did.
Were you in Louisville most of the time?
No, I was in Louisville a good deal of the time. Then I went on a sort of a tour with Clemens through a lot of counties, where we would have sort of half speaking and half organization meetings. They weren't speakings that drew big crowds, but you know where you'd get 100 or 150 people at the courthouse. Mainly politically active people, and they would usually ask me to make a speech. And I traveled with Clemens and Beecham all through western Kentucky and parts of this section, particularly.
Now, at that time, was Phil doing the same thing with Harry Lee? And
he was his veterans champ.
And did he spend much time on his union?
He spent a lot of time on it. Yes, he did.
Lieutenant Law,
well, I guess I attended to it more than he did.
What about the press in that particular campaign? The Herald was the president, Courier Journal for Harry Lee. Do they have their own press secretary to do now?
No.
Do they woo the press?
They wooed the press, but. Of course, Tom Underwood was Clemens' chairman, and he probably was as much a press secretary as anybody. But, and I don't know who they had in Waterfield. Trying to think, who were some of the newspaper men? Waterfield himself was a newspaper man, of course. And Adrian Doran was active in Waterfield's campaign. Smith Broadbent was active in Waterfield's campaign. Lida Donaldson was active in Waterfield's campaign.
Of course, county newspapers back then carried a lot more weight than they
did. Right. And both Clemens and Waterfield cultivated them a great deal. But when you talk about press secretaries, you know, you didn't have a thing where a candidate issued releases every day. called the press, gave them things to print. That wasn't as highly structured as it might be in a campaign today. Now, they used the radio. I remember making some radio speeches for Clinton. But there wasn't any television. And it was Clemens won it handily in the primary. I think he defeated Waterfield by about 30,000 majority, which was pretty big considering the size of the vote.
Clemens had the support of the congressional delegation, did he not?
He certainly had the support of most of them. Of course, you had a Republican from the 7th district. Jack May had been defeated the year before, but Virgil Chapman actively supported Clemens. Noble Gregory from the 1st district actively supported Clemens. Clemens himself was a congressman from the 2nd district. I think Emmett O'Neill from Louisville supported Clemens. Brent Spence, I'm not sure. He probably was mildly pro-Waterfield on account of Lytle Donaldson, because Brent Spence's brother, Judge Giltner Donaldson, was Spence's secretary in Washington. And the congressman were not as reluctant to get involved in primaries in those days, because a governor was considered to have a lot of power in influencing a congressional race when he was governor. And congressional delegation was very much interested in having a friendly governor. And of course, they'd been colleagues of Clemens in the House. Several of those congressmen were very active for him and helped him a lot. Probably were able to help more than they could today.
Let me mention some names here as you respond to them. What your thoughts are on King Johnson?
He supported, probably supported Waterfield mildly, or was neutral. He had been governor when Clemens was fighting against what I referred to as the TVA, or rural electric legislation, in his administration. Clemens had been on the other side before his conversion, and he was very close to Lytle Donaldson. And so we always thought of him as a little bit in the Waterfield camp, although he was not. I believe at that time, he may have been Under Secretary of Labor in the Truman administration. And he and Clemens became good friends after that, though. And Clemens supported him for the Senate in 1960.
But outside that race and simply making statements and endorsements, he was pretty much out of politics for me after his term.
Yeah, although he did run for the U.S. Senate, twice? Or once?
Well, it was in 1960 during John Y. Brown.
John Sherman Cooper. He beat John Y. Brown in the primary. John Sherman Cooper beat him in the November election.
Was he a man of substance?
I always thought that he was basically a rather weak individual. He wasn't a dynamic figure. He was a very honorable person. Turned pretty square corner. But really not very interesting. Didn't have much of a flair. Extremely cautious, and very decent. Wasn't a man of, you know, powerful intellect. Had no dramatic side to him. One felt that he was just a presence, and that he didn't have any major impact on political life once he went out as governor.
Did he have much impact in Washington?
Well, any governor has some impact, and any governor is apt to be, or certainly in those days was apt to be, in some ways, the leader of the party. And yes, he had some impact when he was governor, but it was mostly a negative impact. It was a don't rock the boat sort of impact. He had no major initiatives in his administration.
What about lighter dollars?
Well, Lyda Donaldson was a
old... These were names of province in that time, wasn't
it? Oh, yes. Lyda Donaldson was a old-fashioned regional politician. Came from Carroll County. Had strong ties with the Democratic Party up in Kenton and Camel. Was very close to a priest up there named Father Klosterman, who was very active politically and very influential. He had close ties with a lot of the politicians in Kenton and Camel County. He was on the Highway Commission during the Laffoon administration, supported Tom Ray for governor against Happy. And then when Happy defeated Tom Ray, and Ray and Governor Laffoon bolted the Democratic Party to support Judge Swope, Donaldson refused to do that and remained loyal to the party, which meant that Happy at least had a mild benevolence toward him, but they never became close. He supported Senator Barkley against Chandler in the 1938 senatorial primary, which was a dramatic race. And then he managed King Johnson's campaign in 1939. Did a fairly effective job of bringing a lot of the Barkley faction and the Ray faction into the Johnson camp against John Y. Brown Sr. Then was highway commissioner under King Johnson. He was always very close to the LN Railroad. He represented them in his area. Was little of a power broker. And when he ran for governor in 1943, he was considered a rather capable, intelligent fellow who didn't have a whole lot of imagination about him, who would have made a, you know, governor not unlike him. But he lacked any color or drama, and consequently it was not easy to inspire much enthusiasm for him.
Hello, so John C. Watts, was he active in the campaign?
Oh, I'm sure he was for Clements. He was very close to Clements. In fact, Clements made him the floor leader in the House of Representatives in Frankfort during Clements' first legislative session. And Clements supported him for Congress when Virgil Chapman was elected, ran for the United States Senate in 1948. John Watts started out as a typical rural Central Kentucky politician. County attorney of Jessamine County, very close to Virgil Chapman. That was his closest ally in those days. Then John went to Congress, stayed there, and got into a powerful position on the Ways and Means Committee. He was a money man, made a fortune out of politics, particularly made a fortune out of being on the Ways and Means Committee. He reputed to have left $350,000 in cash in the lockbox when he died. He and Clements were close. He was the campaign manager for Bert Combs after the primary in 1959. John was, again, not a dramatic, popular figure, but he was very good at cultivating local sources of power, his sources in the congressional situation were, of course, very close to the tobacco people, tobacco farmers, very close to the local courthouse politicians, close to Kentucky utilities, close to the what you might call the special interest.
Okay, well, that election is over with then, and Clemens is governor. What was the legislature like in Clemens' administration, the first term legislature, the first session of legislature?
Well, except for a small minority faction, he had it under absolute control in Senate and House. He had two very effective floor leaders, namely John Watts in the House and Dick Maloney in the Senate. Clements had several pieces of legislation that he wanted to get through.
Did you work with him after he was elected governor?
Yeah.
In what capacity?
Oh, none, in no official capacity. I was just
as an advisor.
Yeah. He had several things. He established the state police force. He established the 2 cent rural highway fund. He established the beginnings of our Commerce Department, what was then called Agricultural and Industrial Development Board. He built the Capitol Annex. Considering that the state had very little money. We had no sales tax. We had no big federal programs. And Clements had in many ways the job of making bricks without straw. He was a right effective governor. So much so that the Courier Journal, which had opposed him in the primary in 1947, strongly endorsed him in his Senate race in 1950. Clements really built a hard core party organization, political organization, much the most effective one we've ever had.
Did it make a conscious effort to bring in new blood,
Why, yeah.
It always seems to me to be that it does seem happy as part of the organization. It doesn't happen just without the same old crowd and never reach that.
Well, now, happy, there's this difference. You've got to distinguish between Happy's first term and his second term. In Happy's first term, he brought a lot of new blood in and very good people. Dr. J.W. Martin, Clyde Reeves,
but wasn't that essentially the same blood he relied on the second time? He relied on the N63.
Yeah, but they weren't new blood then.
I know what I'm saying, but I think Clemens looked like he would keep bringing in new people.
Clemens brought in new blood in his administration. Of course, he brought Clyde Reeves back, but that was new blood for Clemens. He brought Felix Joyner into state government. He brought Bob Bell into state government. He brought Teddy Lou Miller into state government. Clements brought new blood in, and some of the blood Clements brought in has been the backbone of Kentucky government for, 25 years. They continued through the Combs administration and the Breathitt administration. Ed Farrick is another one. Clements had very able people in his administration. They weren't all, he had Henry Carter's banking commissioner, so they can't all have been great. But truth is, Clements was the banking commissioner. Henry probably knocked down a little on the loan companies when he issued them licenses. Yes, Clements brought new blood in. And Clements was, you know, he really ran state government, Vic. Clements knew as much about the budget as the budget director did. He would sit down with a budget analyst and go over that portion of the budget, and he could tell you as much about the budget. Clements knew everything that was going on in every department. State government was smaller than. There wasn't much went on in the departments that Clements didn't know about. And he was a very effective administrator. His style of administration was a kind that wouldn't work today, but it worked very effectively during the time he was governor.
What was his style?
Close personal contact with all his departments. A combination of great political acumen, even political ruthlessness on the one hand, and a real concept of what was needed in any particular area of government on the other. The State Highway Patrol had been just a political hack organization for years since it's created under Happy. You know, it was just nothing. Clements built the beginnings of a professional police force in this state, for example. We had never had any coherent effort to build up the economic base of the state. He established the A&ID Board, Agricultural and Industrial Development Board, and that was the beginning of our economic growth in Kentucky. We had a great need for rural highways in Kentucky. We had lots of dirt roads, and lots of gravel roads, and Clements put through the 2 cent gasoline tax. And that funded a whole lot of blacktop roads in the rural areas of this state, which was the beginning of tying the state together and ending some of the isolation that we'd had. But I think Clements, and the way to find out the real truth about Clements is to talk to some of the people that worked under him, because they have continued to have a deep respect and almost idolatry for him while seeing all the sides of his nature. I mean, they're not fools. Clements was ruthless. Clements had a certain lack of scruple about him. He was arbitrary, could be, had a high temper. He had his faults, but he had many, many virtues. And if you talk to people like Ed Ferris and Felix Joyner, Bob Bell, I just think of those offhand, and many others, you would see the respect and admiration and affection they had for Clements.
So,
one, two, three, testing. This is tape number 11, side one, interview with Edward F. Pritchard, April 15, 1983.
I think you have to remember that when Clements was governor, the whole structure and scope of state government was just much simpler than it is today. We didn't human resources. We had then a Department of Economic Security. And what it had was mainly administering some old age pensions and unemployment insurance. We didn't have all the social services that we have today. We didn't have all the federally funded programs administered through the states that we have today. We didn't have the federal aid for education that we have today. We didn't even have as much federal aid for highways as we have today. You had no interstate highway system. You had a much simpler state government. And within the limits of that scope and structure, he had a remarkable command and had remarkable effectiveness in running state government. You know, we didn't have the welfare program that we've got today. We didn't have the food stamps as we have them today. We had a we didn't have the comprehensive care centers. We didn't, you know, LRC was a vestigial thing as compared with now. It was had no staff. You had a director and a small staff, but you had no committee system in the legislature. If the budget was introduced on a Monday, it'd come out and be voted on a Wednesday. Go to the other house and be read on a Wednesday. And passed on a Friday and signed by the governor on Friday night. That was the way you passed the budget. It was passed without any amendments, with very little debate.
What kind
of legislation was passed pretty much on the word of the law of the first, then called the first floor, I guess. No, where was the governor's office then? It wasn't on the first floor. It was on the second, wasn't it?
I don't know. I always assumed it was on the first floor.
Oh, no. It was either on the third or the second. Where's the state reception room?
Second.
That's where the governor's office was, right next to the state reception room. Because the state reception room was supposed to be a part of the governor's office. The first governor I remember in the state reception room was Governor Sampson, when I was probably 13, 14 years old. School children would go to Frankfort to see the sights. And we went in the state reception room, and Sampson came in with his secretary, and he had people waiting all around to see him. And he'd go along and see people and hear what they wanted, and his secretary would make notes. And that's the way he saw people, rather than by their having appointments in the office. And that's what the state reception room in part was for, where people would go, and the governor would have certain hours when he went there to receive people. And so most of the legislation came down from the second floor and was passed with damn few amendments.
What sorts of things did Governor Clemens call on you for advice?
Well, I worked with him on the legislation that created LRC. I worked on that. Worked with him on the legislation creating a state police force. The rural highway legislation. Agricultural Industrial Board. I worked with him particularly in the first session. I worked on second session, I was beginning to be in trouble. Wasn't as available or as that much interested. But I worked with him quite a lot. Worked with him in the 1948 campaign. Went with him to the Democratic National Convention in 1948. I was on the platform committee, where we had to fight over the civil rights plan. And that was, as I said, in Philadelphia. And Philadelphia, there was great hesitancy about Truman's chances, a great feeling that Truman couldn't win. And everybody went to Philadelphia in a mood of defeatism. And we were, you know, we thought we'd have a better chance to win the presidential race if we could get Barclay as the candidate instead of Truman. But that was obviously impossible. Truman had enough power to control that convention as any incumbent president would. There were even a fraction of people led by Claude Pepper who wanted to run Eisenhower on the Democratic ticket. But when Barclay made that great keynote speech the opening night, it electrified that crowd and began to turn people around. Now, it didn't make Barclay a presidential candidate, but we began to think then that his chances of being the vice presidential candidate were good, and Clemens and I went in a little dining room down the basement of the hotel, and I wrote a statement on the back of an envelope for Clemens to issue in which we said we were going to put Barclay in nomination for vice president. And we went up the next morning after that keynote speech. Barclay was still asleep, and he got up full of piss and vinegar. And we told him what we were going to do, and he didn't try to stop us. And, of course, it ended up with Barclay's being nominated unanimously. Truman had fooled around with Justice Douglas and somebody else he talked about, but none of them got off the ground except Barclay.
Did Truman want Barclay?
He wasn't Barclay's first choice. I mean, Barclay wasn't his first choice. Barclay really thought Truman ought to get out of the presidential race and let him be the nominee. He told us that morning. He said if he's really a big man, he'd get out.
I guess bigness always depends on which side of the picture.
Oh, exactly. But I do think that Barclay was a natural, and I think being on the ticket with Truman probably helped Truman, and I'm not sure it didn't make a real difference in that year. I think Barclay was a big asset to that ticket. All right, let me undo it. Of course, Truman, in 1948, Clemens' big problem was Chapman. Chapman wanted to run for the Senate, and my opinion is Clemens was committed to back him for the Senate as a result of his support of Clemens in the 1947 primary. Chapman was very unpopular with labor, very unpopular with the blacks, very unpopular with the Sea Green Roosevelt Democrats, who regard him as a kind of a Southern reactionary. But he had the support of the Clemens administration in the primary. John Y. Brown went against him, and John Y. Brown was considered a, you know, threadbare candidate, had run by that time 4, 5, or 6 times, had no money, no organization, and Chapman beat him. And then Cooper was there. Of course, Republican nominee for re-election, he having been elected to the Senate in 46. I told you about that, Larrace, last time. And Cooper ran 100,000 votes ahead of the ticket, and Chapman still beat it. Truman carried the state 125,000 majority, and Chapman had 20,000 majority. And Clemens was trying very hard to get, I can remember on the train when Truman went through the state. I was on the train with Truman and Clemens, went clear through the CNO, Cincinnati, that's where it was, down to Lexington. Let's see, Cincinnati to Maysville to Lexington. Cincinnati to Maysville to Ashland to Lexington to Louisville through Franklin. And that's when I first began to believe Truman could win, because he was drawing these huge crowds. You know, you came through Lexington here, and there must have been 10, 12, 15,000 people out there just at the train. And Chapman was on the train, and Truman and
Clements were trying to get him to endorse the Democratic platform, which came out against the Taft-Hartley labor law and some of those things, and for some civil rights legislation. And Chapman kept refusing and refusing, and Clements finally walked out of the Pullman car and said, "God damn it, you son of a bitch, paddle your own canoe." But he didn't leave him. And as a result of Truman and Barclay's big majority, Chapman was elected. Didn't make a damn bit of difference how he voted on those laws, though.
Well, Governor Clemens had a reputation for being a rather abrupt man when his patience was tried. Was that a...
That was an accurate reputation. He had a terrible temper. He'd shake people.
Actually shake them?
Yeah. I can remember once out Ms. Holmes. You remember, you've heard of Ms. Holmes.
Yes.
That's where they all used to eat. Daddy and Clemens and Dick Maloney and all their cronies. They were out there one night, and there had been a bill in the session to repeal the 3-day marriage law. You know what I mean.
Yes.
The county clerks from the river counties were sponsoring the bill because they thought it lost them business. And one of the county clerks that's most active in supporting the bill was a county clerk from Henderson named Billy McClure. Billy was a great friend of Clemens, but he wanted to repeal the 3-day marriage law. And Clemens, you know, Clemens really tried to be on the right side of a lot of issues, and Clemens thought it would be just terrible. And all of his people, like Drs. Lillian South, you know, in the health department, got on him, and Clemens determined to beat that bill to repeal the 3-day marriage law. But one of the senators that was kind of wobbly on it was Senator Stanley Hoffman from Henderson, and who was also a close friend of Clemens.
Judge Hoffman's daddy?
He's John Stanley's father, that's right. Still living, Stanley is. And we were sitting out to Ms. Holmes one night, and Stanley Hoffman, who really had been against Clemens and for repealing that law, but came along when they mobilized the ranks, you know, and supported Clemens. But he made some little joke about it. And Clemens jumped up and grabbed him by the lapels and started shaking him and saying, "God damn you." And Stanley says, "But Earl, why are you shaking me? I voted with you on the bill. I voted against the bill." Earl kept on shaking him and said, "Yes, but you got too goddamn much pleasure out of it to suit me." Now, that was a typical Clemens.
Is it true that Senator used to go on the floor of the chamber? And
why, hell, set up in the next to the president's seat in the last night of the session. Set up there. In the 50th session, I wasn't there, but Cash Holbrook was sergeant at arms. Cash was carrying a pistol around. Clemens went up there and took the pistol away from him and dropped it down between his feet on the floor and sat there till the session adjourned. Of course he sat on the floor. And might shake a senator or a representative if they weren't going with him. Oh, it was a tightly controlled legislature.
Was there any, or were there any dissidents at all?
Yeah. Morris Weintraub, Leonard Preston, they were a few.
What about the power of the lobbyists in the 48 and 50 sessions? Did it all come through the governor?
They had to lobby with the governor if they were going to get anywhere. Lobbyists around. There were truck lobbyists and railroad lobbyists and labor lobbyists and utility lobbyists and rural co-op lobbyists, but The only place worth lobbying is Clemens.
Well, how about a fellow named Hugh Morris? Did he report the Courier on him?
Oh, yeah. Isn't Hugh living?
Oh, yeah, very much so.
He worked up at LRC.
Yes, sir. He retired 3 years ago.
I knew that. Hugh was the, I guess, really head of the Frankfurt Bureau of the Courier-Journal. And Hugh wrote, you know, the Courier-Journal had a rather different kind of Frankfurt coverage in those days.
Yes,
well, it was more what I would have called opinion journalism, not on the editorial page, but it was, now when I say it was slanted, I don't mean it was illicitly slanted, but it delved into things. It wasn't just something hung around facts. A lot of analysis, if you know what I mean. And Hugh wrote a lot. And of course, he bugged them. Because they, you know, if he wrote things that didn't please them, why, they'd get mad. I don't think they ever thought he was dishonest. And I think they finally came to have a lot of affection for him.
But Errol never felt like shaking him.
He might have felt like it, but he never did. He shook John Ed Pierce, though.
Is that right?
Lifted him up off the floor and banged his head against that marble wall. I saw it in the 48th session. Just pulled him right up off the floor and shook him and batted his head.
What occasion that shaking?
Well, there had been a bill up, which I was lobbying for.
And John Ed was writing the Courier this time.
Yeah, I was lobbying for the bill, for the co-op. A bill to extend the period over which they could issue bonds. Well, Clemens had made a commitment to both sides of the utility issue that he wouldn't allow any utility legislation, whether favorable to the co-ops or the private utilities, to pass. Well, this was a non-controversial bill. Nobody was opposed to it. It passed unanimously in one house. And they just extended the period over which they could issue bonds from 20 years to 30 years. But Clemens got the idea he'd made a commitment there'd be no legislation and there'd be none. And so he sent the word out to kill that bill, and it was killed. Well, I didn't like it, but I understood what he was doing, and there wasn't a damn thing I could do about it. And he had done a whole lot of things. You know, he had appointed a Public Service Commission that gave us our first G&T power plant, and he actually had been very favorable, and he didn't sponsor any legislation to gut our TVA bill. So I thought this was a minor thing, and it was, but John Ed just asked him in a sassy way, says, why'd you kill that utility thing? Did the KU get you to do that or something like that? And Clemens just picked him up and started banging that head against that marble. Sounded like a watermelon. Oh, listen, he was rough.
Did you read about that in the paper the next day?
I'm not sure whether John Ed put it in the paper. I don't think so. He shook Dr. Donovan.
President University?
Yeah.
What was that about? When you said that Errol Clemens was a shaker in the movie, you really meant it, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, Dr. Donovan had claimed that there was some legislation on the books that gave the governor power to remove members of the Board of Trustees. You know, Willis had exercised that power, and Moorhead had been discredited during the Willis administration because he did that to get rid of the president up at Moorhead, Dr. Vaughn, and put his friend Babb in up there. And that caused Moorhead to lose its accreditation. Well, Clemens got Moorhead reaccredited after he came in. But there was still a statute on the books that left the governor with the power to remove members of the Board of Trustees. And Donovan came over there lobbying to get it repealed. And Clemens didn't really give that much of a damn about it, but he thought they were attacking him, thought they were intimating that he wanted to fire trustees and so forth. So he and Donovan got in a little argument, and Clemens shook him. Don't you remember, Happy, when you ran later, 55, used to refer to Clemens as the great shaker,
no.
And said he shook Dr. Donovan. And you know, Doc Beecham was always very sensitive about a lot of things. People didn't know that. And one time I went through all the people that Clements had shaken, and Doc said, "You never shoot me." And I don't think he ever did. But yes, he'd shake people.
Did he have a sense of humor?
On his terms. On his terms, yes. And you can kid him about shaking people now. I kid him about it. Yes, I'll tell you one of the funniest stories I ever remember. Mac Sisk and I were there. We were up in his office. Mac was his press secretary, you know, for a while. And there were a delegation from somewhere coming up there to talk to him about a road or a park or something. And they were gathered around, and I was standing there waiting to see him. And this bum got in somehow, and he mingled in this crowd of business people. And he was bumming 50 cents off of each one of them. And he got up to Clements, and he said, "How about a half a dollar?" Clements said to him, says, "You take the other side of the room. This is my side." I thought that was pretty good.
That was sure. Interesting you mentioned Max Sisk during the campaign. He didn't have a press secretary. At what point did he feel it was?
He was the first press secretary to any governor. He was Clements' press secretary and later Weatherby.
Why didn't Governor Clements find it necessary to have a press secretary?
Well, I guess every governor by that time was coming to have one. You know, the press got more active and you had to pay more attention to it, and there were more and more newspapers that had correspondence that, and I just guess the same thing that led candidates and everybody else to have press secretaries led a governor to have it. I'm not sure whether his first press secretary was Max Sisk or George Curler, but they were both there and they served for him and Weatherby. Ed Farish was his executive secretary, ran the office. That's how Ed started in state government. One of the characters that was very close to Clements, never had any job. I've always thought he was on the KU payroll and the truckers' payroll to some extent. And he ended up dying with a lot of money in a lockbox, or at least they thought he did. His name was Scoop Sherwood, W. Sigsby Sherwood. And he had gone to Euclid K with Clements. And he was sort of half bum and half genius, if you know what I mean. And he was in the governor's office every day when Clements was governor and never was on the state payroll. And there was some belief that he might have received some benefits from some people that sold highway equipment to the state, that he might have had a silent partnership with some dealer. And when he died, Kelly left $45,000 in a lockbox, and there was always some opinion on the part of his widow, whose name's Polly, and may still be living down in Todd County, that's where she came from, that Clements wanted to try to get in that lockbox and that silent partnership was really his. Now, I never believed that, and Dick Maloney never believed it. I think he just let his friend Sherwood make a little money off a couple of these vendors. But Polly got neurotic about it after Sherwood died. And you recall that when Clements was governor, probably the big thing that adversely affected Clements politically was his tax troubles. And that started when he was governor. There were a lot of money collected for political purposes from highway contractors, vendors of highway equipment, people of that sort. And that was to be used, and was primarily used, for political campaigns. you know, nobody ever reported things then. It was all done in cash. And the money was always kept in a safe in the office of Henry Carter, who was the banking commissioner. And I believe they accumulated about, $125,000, $150,000. And when Clemens went to Washington, was elected to the Senate, Henry Carter was instructed to get all that money out of the safe and put it in a big suitcase and get on the train and go to Washington, which he did. And Clemens took that money up there, and he used it for political campaigns. He used it for for Combs's 55 campaign. He used it for Watts's congressional campaign. He used it for Barclay's presidential campaign in 1952 in the convention. And when Barclay died in 1956, wasn't it? Very suddenly. You know, Barclay was in the biggest tax trouble that anybody could be in. He had thousands of dollars in cash on his person. He had thousands of dollars in cash at his apartment. He had thousands of dollars in cash in the bank. He'd accumulated property. And there isn't any doubt that from the time he his wife first got seriously ill with heart trouble and had to have nurses around the clock, that Barclay formed the habit of making speeches all over the country and would get $2,500, $5,000 a speech. His salary then was about $10,000 a year. And that he persuaded himself that he didn't have to pay income tax on that money, and he never reported it. Well, just before he died, they were beginning to investigate him. And after he died, they took 80% of everything he had. But in the course of that investigation, they ran into some money that Clemens had put into his presidential effort in 1952. And that caused Clemens to be audited. And they charged up all that money to him as taxable income. And they threatened to indict him. Now, this came to a head in about 1963, 62 or 3. And Clemens settled the matter by paying him $60,000+. And he wasn't indicted. Now, there is some belief, which I cannot confirm or disprove, that Happy Chandler went to see Bobby Kennedy. You see, in the Wyatt campaign of 62, after Combs fell out, Happy and Clemens formed a sort of an uneasy alliance. And there's widespread belief that Happy went to see Bobby Kennedy and got the Department of Justice to agree not to prosecute Clemens. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but that is supposed to be one of the reasons that Clemens supported Happy in 1963.